show. It's another book club edition today. But these books are for young readers and provided by school librarians statewide. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The Alaska Spirit of Reading program has brought Roland Smith to the state. He writes about climbing, exploring, wildlife rehabilitation, and other things, witness protection. Your call to welcome at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, and Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@aprn.org. Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Well, this is always a fun show to do. We did it last year, and it was just an absolute blast. And I'm sure we're going to have ourselves a good time on Talk of Alaska. The telephone number 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, a local call of 550-8422. But the majority of the participants in this program are actually outside the city of Anchorage, and our guest Roland Smith is in Sitka, at the middle school there, I believe. Right, Roland?
At the high school, Sitka High School.
Sitka High School. Well, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roland. It's good to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And Roland is the author of Peak, Thunder Cave, Sea Otter Rescue, The Aftermath of an Oil Spill. And what is that other one you have over there? I haven't seen this one. It's called Zach's Lie. Is Zach's Lie the most recent one?
Actually not. The most recent one is Tentacles, but I've written like 27 books. But that's a good sampling.
Wow. That would be quite an investment if the program was to provide all of your books to these kids.
Yeah, it would. It would. In fact, I don't even know if I own all of them.
Well, I'm going to kick it off, but I have two students from Golden View Middle School who are going to join in the Inquisition here, Roland. So
okay,
be prepared. And then in the second half hour, along with any callers that call in, I understand that they have some high school students there, that Jenny Blackson, the librarian, has arranged to be with you there. So this should be interesting. And I'm going to start with this. Are you acquainted with Roald Dahl's children's fiction?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Seems to me that you share a certain characteristic with him, and I'm going to put it just bluntly. It's a form of subversion. I mean, you see a little bit of in Sendak, but you really see it in Dahl, and he admitted on the record that he was doing this. In other words, in Peak, for instance, we start out with some kid climbing the Woolworth building. This is not exactly what we want our kids to be doing here, Roland. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. So what is this? They're having adventures, but they're also doing things that we don't want our kids doing.
Well, exactly. And, of course, I wouldn't want my kids to do them either. But if they're not doing something a little bit over the top, then nobody's going to be interested in reading about that kid. And I think that shares something with adult fiction as well. I mean, you obviously write about people a little bit outside the box because they're more interesting than people who are inside the box.
Well, I'm going to start in on, I guess, Peak, because that's the one that I read first and that involved me the deepest. And I haven't finished Thunder Cave, and the other ones I just don't know. And the Sea Otter book, we'll get around to that one too, because it's kind of fun to talk about that. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to some of the things you talk about in that book about your own experience. But In Peak, maybe you could just synopsize the plot, and maybe in a way that doesn't give away. It has some surprises and so forth.
Yeah, sure. Peak is about a character oddly named Peak, and his father is a famous high altitude climber. His mother is an ex climber, and he lives in New York City with his mom and his new dad, who's not a climber at all, and he gets busted for climbing a skyscraper in New York City. And to get out of the jam, his father shows up and takes him to Everest on the Tibetan side. So it's not over the top or anything.
No. And indeed, there is if he's able to make it to the peak of this mountain, he's going to be the youngest person ever to climb it.
Correct, and that would be quite a sort of a little bit of a head start for him. But there's some other again, we don't want to give anything away, but there's some other another person involved in that, and he certainly learns a lot more about himself and what really matters in life than he does about summiting mountains.
Well, I'd like to, at this point, to introduce Becca Padrick. She's a seventh grader at Golden View Middle School in Anchorage. Becca, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Why, thank you.
I would like, you've read Roland's books. Did you read Peak?
I did read Peak.
And also Thunder Cave.
Mm-hmm.
And, is anything you'd like to talk to him about?
Something I noticed in Peak, and many of your books, actually, was that they often keep a journal on what they're doing. Do you keep a journal?
Actually, I used to keep a journal, but I write, a lot of my characters write in a little journal called a Moleskine, sometimes called a Moleskine. And I write the rough drafts of most of my books in those little notebooks. And of course, you do take things from your own life and kind of hand them to your characters, because your main characters are basically you, an exaggerated form of you, or at least somebody who you'd like to be. And so they write their stories often in a Moleskine journal. But for years and years and years, I did keep a diary and a journal, and I think that that helped me to become a good writer, because I think one of the things you need to do if you want to write books is you need to discover your own voice. And one of the best ways to discover your voice is to keep a journal and write in it every single day. And another thing is, don't show it to anybody. Because if you show it to somebody, then you'll be sort of writing for them instead of for yourself, and you won't actually be honest in it. So if you do keep a journal or a diary, you need to find a good hiding place for it that nobody can find it, including your parents, by the way.
So, Becca, do you keep one?
I actually do keep a journal.
Yeah. Do you carry it around with you?
I do not, because I have very many friends who would love to read that.
So you're doing it right, Becca.
I carry a journal, but I'm always forgetting it, so then I get another one. So after a while, I got five or six journals going. Roland, do you keep the book with you? Do you have a place where you sit down and do? I take it you're writing cursive then, if you're writing into a little book.
Yeah, I actually print, but my cursive is really horrible. But I print really neatly, so I can read it later. And a laptop is not really portable, and you're not going to get that out. And because I travel a lot and speak a lot, my routine on the road is, I go to sleep really early, wake up at 4, write for 3 hours, go out and speak, and usually jump on an airplane and go someplace. But if I'm carrying my book around with me and my little notebook, then I really have no excuse for not writing. And lugging that little notebook around actually reminds me that I am a writer. Writers do a lot of things besides write. And the only time I'm a writer is when I'm actually writing. So tonight I'll fly out of here and be working on my book, because it's really easy to do. I just pull the notebook out and start working on a book, as I did this morning before I came to the high school. So I think you really need to have it with you all the time to kind of remind you what you actually really do for a living.
Wow. I think this is something that many listeners may not realize, but when you're especially I think in the creative fields, sometimes those early hours, despite the reputation of artists as being bohemians that stay up late and so forth, sometimes those very early hours are by far the most productive ones. And having the discipline, and especially writers, you know, need to have this, the discipline of facing that every morning, it can be a pretty good way of getting more words out.
Well, I think so, but I mean, I use an alarm to wake up, and so, and I know, and I never really liked that word discipline. It sounds like it's punishment, really. I mean, I've written every day, 7 days a week for the last 40 years, so my days are basically planned around when I'm going to get my writing in, so I know when my flights are, I know when my speaking schedule is, and I'm going, okay, the day before I say, okay, I'll wake up before, I'll get this in, and then I have a flight, and I'll work then. And because I always have books that are due. I have six books under contract right now. And, of course, everybody in New York 4 hours away is saying, where are you? And I go, I'm in Alaska. They go, you're working? I go, sure.
Go ahead, Becca.
Okay. Here's another question. I'm kind of related to the Roald Dahl. Who is your favorite author? Because we're talking a lot about you.
Yeah, first of all, I'm not my favorite author, so we'll get that out of the way right now. I read 2 or 3 books every week, and I've done that for 40 years. And I think that actually the reason I became a writer and is because I have a lot of things in my head from reading other people's books. So it's always hard to pick one favorite writer because I have many that I really like, but if you made me pick one favorite author, one favorite book, it would be Harper Lee, and she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. And that is like a perfect book. It has perfect voice. I've read it many, many times. I have 5 copies. I actually have you'll like this, about 6-7 years ago, my oldest daughter, Christmas, she gives me a present. They don't know what to get me because I'm a guy and their dad. And so she gave me a book, and I opened it up, and it was a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird. And being a nice dad, I said, oh, thank you so much, and thinking to myself, I have 5 copies of this book on my bookshelf. And she says, open it up. And I opened mine up, and mine was signed by Harper Lee.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Harper Lee doesn't sign books. She doesn't go out in public, but my daughter knew somebody who knew her, who went to her house and had them sign that book for me. So it's actually one of my prized possessions. If my house caught fire, I would grab 3 things: that book, my flash drive, and my wife. Not in that order. Not in that order.
You know, this really kind of that is a great anecdote, and it kind of brings me back to I think one of the things that's very engaging about your work, which is you do not spare the heart connection in your characters. That these are people that are, at least in the ones that I've read so far, going through some fairly profound moral situation where they're going to find the deeper aspects of their own character.
Yeah, I mean, I think that everybody, our favorite books are character-driven books, and I don't think anybody would read my books unless they care about the character. So even though like Peak is about climbing Mount Everest, it's actually not about climbing Everest, it's about the character Peak and what he's going through. And I think the thing that really makes us turn the pages in the book, I know for myself and for most people, we have to really care about the character to get through that book. We want to know what happens to them. We're concerned about them, and that's what keeps me reading a book, and hopefully that's what keeps people reading my books as well.
Well, yeah. Not having finished Thunder Cave, I'm going to have to turn to Becca as the expert on the book. But it appears where I am, which is a little bit more than halfway through, so we've had kind of an epiphany happen in Africa at this point, involving a drum and you know, trying to get the rain to happen. And I don't know how the book comes out, but Becca, would you say that this character undergoes, it seems to me, he's learned some very significant things.
Definitely.
Yeah. Do you got any questions about that book?
Actually, I do have a question. Although it's not a very major question.
Yeah, that's the best kind.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll make it major, Becca.
Yeah.
It'll be no problem.
Okay. Is there a specific reason you chose Africa as opposed to South America?
Yeah, because I wanted to write about African elephants, and they're not found in South America.
True.
So, and I went to Kenya, and it's been a month, a little more than a month, actually doing research for that book. And I used to be a conservation biologist. I worked with elephants in Africa and in Asia, and wanted to write a novel about this boy, but also about the ivory trade with African elephants. And of course, since I'd been to Kenya, that's where I placed it. But I mean, you bring up a good point. I mean, the book could happen anywhere in Africa where they have elephants, not South America, but anywhere. And so Kenya is a place that I was familiar with. And so that's why I placed it there. But there are certainly a number of other countries in the continent of Africa that it could have taken place.
Yeah, I notice your experience with wildlife maybe informs this as well. It's very striking when you describe how the prey animals, like the zebras, for instance, will behave once one of their number is taken.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they just, okay, it's over now.
It's over.
That lion's not going to win anything else.
Yeah, I mean, what he's talking about is that the chase goes on, and then a lion or a cheetah pulls down one of the zebras, and then everybody goes, okay, let's go graze, because the predator has its food. And it's an amazing thing, seriously. There's a bunch of terror until they pull down one of their running mates, and then everybody goes, cool, we're fine now.
That had to be personally experienced.
It is. Well, it happens up here in Alaska, too.
Oh, yeah.
Caribou and wolves, you know. I mean, the same thing happens. You get that big mad run, and then the wolves pull down something to eat, and then everybody else slows down and goes, okay, let's continue the migration. It's okay now.
Okay. Benton Campbell of Golden View, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi.
Hi, Ben.
Ben, would you get the book you're looking at? Is
I'm actually looking at Zach's Lie right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of wondering, have you ever had to change who you are to do something new, to change who you are to make new friends?
Yeah. No, it'd be really hard for me to be in the... Let me explain what Zach's Lie is about. Zach's Lie is a story about a boy and his family put into the witness security program. And how that works is that if for some unfortunate reason, Ben, your parents got in trouble, or Becca, and there were bad guys after your family, the government might put your family in a witness security program. And if that happened, here's what would happen to you. You'd be moved out of Alaska to a new state, new town, new school, and you'd have your first and last name changed, and you'd never be able to contact anybody you knew in your previous life ever again, including relatives. And there's about 8,000 people in the witness security program today, and about one-third of them are young people your age. And when I found that out, that became important to me, so I wrote Zach's Lie. But as an author, as a public figure, it'd be really hard for me to sort of change my name and disappear because I'm, like, out in the public. You know, I'm on TV and in the newspaper and stuff, so I'd make a terrible candidate for the witness security program. The bad guys could find me immediately.
So, and Ben, this is your favorite book of Roland's?
I think it is, yes.
Oh, good.
How come?
It seems super realistic to me. Even though he's gone through a lot of trauma in his life, he finds a way to get back up on his feet and make new friends and get a job and help his mom, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you read the sequel? There's a second one, too.
I read it a few years ago, so I don't remember that much about it.
Jack's Run. It has the sequel. You have to read those two books in order. Some of my series you don't have to, but those two are probably in order. And Jack's Run kind of continues the story, but it has something to do with my favorite television show, which is American Idol.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't have time to watch much TV anyway.
I don't watch TV. No, I have a TiVo, though, one of the greatest inventions of the 20th century.
That's what my son keeps telling me.
When I get home, I didn't buy it. My son-in-law bought it for me. I didn't know what it was. I said, what's a TiVo? He goes, just use it. And I went, oh, it's cool.
Okay, well, Roland, I'd like to turn to our callers now. And from Sitka, Chatham joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chatham.
Hello, I'm Chatham, and I'm calling in for the Sea School in Sitka.
Hi, Chatham.
We came to your presentation yesterday in Sitka at the library.
Oh, last night. Yeah, good.
Yes. And the question is, are you going to write any more Jacob Lanza books? Thunder Cave.
Yeah. So there's three Jake Lanza books. There's Thunder Cave, Jaguar, and The Last Lobo. And I was going to write a fourth book, but what I might do is I might have Jake appear in another series. In fact, he already did. I wrote a book called Cryptid Hunters, and I wrote a sequel called Tentacles, which is my newest book. And Jake Lanza makes an appearance in Tentacles. And he's tied to those characters in Cryptid Hunters and Tentacles, in that his father's working in South America at a Jaguar reintroduction area. And this is the same place where one of the characters, this is kind of convoluted, but one of the characters in Tentacles and Cryptid Hunters, their parents went down in a crash, and they're lost. So I think what I'll be able to do, rather than do a fourth book, and I'm not saying I won't do a fourth book just about Jake Lanza, he's certainly going to be tied up in this other series. And I often do that in my books, where characters step from one series to another series. Nobody knows it unless they've read all those series, but it's kind of a nice little surprise for them.
So you've got your own world going. Is it running your life now? I mean, or do you just sort of step into it to, you know, and find the books writing themselves?
Well, I wish the books wrote themselves. That would be really nice. I mean, because then I'd have a tremendous amount of time, and I wish they'd invent a computer that wrote its own story. You just go, okay, write this, you know. But no, I have to work pretty hard at them. I usually have at least one book come out a year, and sometimes two, but I'm not particularly a really fast writer. I spend a lot of time doing it, and as I'm doing it, I always sort of see little niches where I might be able to let other characters step in. And a lot of times, this is somewhat ironic, my editors, and I write for several different publishers, but my editors never get it, meaning they might edit a book with one character, I put that character into another completely different series, and they never mention it, which means they don't know. Or they don't remember anyway, which I think is very funny.
Editors
tell them either, because I'm kind of mean-spirited. I don't say anything.
Editors these days. Well,
yeah,
the important thing is the connection with the readers. Chatham, are you still with us there in Sitka?
What?
Are you still with us? You have more you want to ask or say?
Well, the Sioux School kids really love Thunder Cave, and we just ordered some of your other books, and we are really happy that you wrote Thunder Cave.
Oh, thanks very much. You know, I think you'll enjoy the two other books, too, with him, with Jake, Jaguar, and The Last Lobo. And if you read Cryptid Hunters and Tentacles, you'll see Jake and Tentacles, too. So he's around. You know, I have a really hard time letting go of characters. They're kind of my friends, so I try not to let them fade into the distance too far.
Yeah. Ben, you got more?
Do you think it would be harder emotionally to be put into the witness protection program as a kid or as an adult? Whereas if you're a kid, you lose all your friends and everyone you know, but as an adult, you lose all that you've worked for your whole life. Which do you think would be a harder transition?
Honestly, I think it'd be much harder on someone young. Adults, you know, I mean, first of all, it's their fault they're in the witness security program. you know, it's not the kid's fault, usually. And I think that it'd be more difficult because when you're growing up, you know, you have to make friends and stuff. I mean, and I think it's really a strange situation to have a cover story, and everybody that you meet, you're basically lying to about who you actually really are. And it would certainly be hard for adults, but honestly, I believe it'd be much harder for someone young to keep the story straight, because I think young people are a lot more spontaneous than adults and, you know, a lot more casual, less guarded, let's say. And to make you guarded as a young person, I think is a real shame and a very difficult thing to do.
Do your young protagonists all tend to screw up? I mean, I don't know if you know John Straley's character, the detective who's always screwing up. He lives in Sitka, you know, he writes.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that the young characters that I've run across in your book so far tend to make some fairly major mistakes.
Well, they make major mistakes, but usually what catapults them into the story are the mistakes their parents make. They're basically responding to their parents' mistakes, so, you know, they're a little bit more sympathetic, I think, than the parents.
See, I knew you were subversive.
I know. See, it's bad. I know it's a bad thing.
Well, before we take our break and bring in the kids at the high school in Sitka into the conversation, Roland, I wanted to take up this book, Sea Otter Rescue, which I guess has come out some time ago, but it's based on your own experience responding to the Exxon Valdez oil spill so many years ago now.
Mm-hmm. And you were, it was actually my first book that I got published. It came out in 1990. And I think it was the first book that came out about the Valdez oil spill, which happened in 89.
Yeah. I remember that fairly well because, you know, as a journalist, I had to go. And the radio station, as you may recall, was directly across from where they were bringing the sea otters.
Yeah.
And also the birds at first there in the community college.
Right, in the gymnasium.
Yeah, and I distinctly remember a story I did where I heard I went out there at night one and I heard the sea otter scream.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a story without using the sound of the sea otter screaming because I felt there was a pornography to it that I did not want to share with the listeners.
Mm-hmm.
That it was something so profoundly indecent that it really shouldn't be on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And you went all the way to, you know, you were part of the project in Seward, Jackloff, and the whole deal. I mean,
right.
I guess from your point of view, it was somewhat of a success story.
Well, I mean, I think to some degree. I was asked to lead a team of biologists from Washington State to help rescue the sea otters because at the zoo I was affiliated with, we had sea otters, so we had some experience with them, but not nearly enough. And so we came up to help catch sea otters, to train people how to handle sea otters. They're very difficult to handle. To come up with some techniques for immobilizing them, which we didn't really, no one knew how to do, by the way, before that spill. And how to do some other odd things, like feed them, like how to milk a sea otter, a mom sea otter, so you can give the milk to a baby and give them colostrum. So these are all really new things that we sort of had to invent on the spot. And it was a really interesting experience. Someone asked me yesterday at a school if I liked the experience, and the answer is absolutely not. I mean, I would, you know, that's an experience I could certainly live without because you know, it was a very hard time. I mean, it was a huge disaster up here, a huge impact on not just wildlife, but the economy of Alaska, and we need to quit spilling that oil. And it wasn't a lot of fun. We wore survival suits. We crashed a lot of boats along the rocky shores. We were in the water a lot. We were sick because of the oil, you know, sends out interesting toxic fumes that make you sick. And I didn't write a lot about in that book because that sounds whiny, but we managed to catch 400 sea otters and save 300 of those 400, but 5,000 sea otters died and 250,000 birds, these are estimates, which is a huge hit to the wildlife and for the people of Alaska. So we were moderately successful. I think the most positive thing that came from the oil spill is that we're now prepared for the next oil spill, should there be one. Hope there isn't, but there probably will be. And we kind of know how to do this now. And all that equipment that Exxon bought and is on barges in Seward, Alaska, and it's ready to go. And in a rescue operation like this, it takes a while to get geared up and get ready to go. This time, if it happens again, we'll be geared up and ready to go almost instantly, which is a, a good thing.
You say this was your first book. Was it a success?
Yeah, actually, it was a pretty good success. I write just novels now, but and I wrote 10 nonfiction books, Sea Otter Rescue being the first one. The other 9 nonfiction books, which I thought were really good, are all out of print. So Sea Otter Rescue is still hanging in there after 20 years, so apparently it has some legs, and it's a very interesting story, and it's taught in a lot of schools because that was a huge disaster, and it's a good way to teach people about basically what not to do.
Yeah, well, my copy's going right to my grandkids.
Oh, good.
I think that they'll find it a worthwhile thing to read, and also it's bathed in reality, which I think is really, really good. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And email is talk@aprn.org. Our guest is Roland Smith. He's the author of Peak, Zach's Lie, Thunder Cave, Sea Otter Rescue, and some 30-odd other books. And he'll be with us for the second half hour as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, unlocking Alaska's energy potential. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
Talk of Alaska, and today we're dealing with the Spirit of Reading author, which is a great program run by school librarians, and they get the good stuff for the kids, and then they get the authors for the kids to engage with. So I am really happy to be able to participate in a show like this that kind of encourages the reading habit, because it did so much for me. As a young person, I mean, certainly contributed to my moral instruction and to my to my ability to handle words and language and so forth in my own business. And I think we need more reading going on. We endlessly fuss about trying to encourage young people to read, and here somebody's actually doing the job. Some school librarians. Well, who'd have thunk it? So if we have the speakerphone connected there, Roland Smith down in Sitka, who do we have with you there?
I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
All right.
I'm Chandra.
Neil Malone.
I'm Cameron Mutchler.
And Ginny Blackson.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ginny. Ginny's the librarian. And so if you can just, maybe we'll just listen in here. And one of you kids can go ahead and just pop in with a question, and Roland, you just go ahead and answer it, and we'll bust in on it too if we got something to say.
Okay.
So how much research do you tend to do for your books?
That's a good question. He says, how much research do I do? It generally takes me twice as long to do the research for a book as it does to write the book. So when I wrote Thunder Cave, which we were talking about earlier, it took 18 months to do the research and 9 months to write the book. I wrote a book about Lewis and Clark called The Captain's Dog. It took 2 years to do the research and 1 year to write the book. So I do a lot of research. In fact, that's sort of how I figure out if I want to write that book.
Another question there?
When you wrote on Peak about climbing the skyscraper, how did you get that idea?
Peak climbing the skyscrapers is not really an idea. It actually is something that happens quite commonly in New York City. And oftentimes they don't really talk about it because they don't want people doing it. So they try not to give them any advertisement, but there are people in New York who do climb skyscrapers all the time. I don't recommend it, by the way. But
No. Don't do this at home.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Don't do what I write about.
So exactly how did you get inspired to write Peak? Exactly.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the word inspiration, because the truth is that I don't really get inspired.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a fallacy that a lot of people have about writers, is that we wake up in the morning and some bolt of lightning hits us in the head and we go, oh, that never happens to me. When I wake up in the morning at 4 o'clock, I'm actually tired. And my head is empty. This is a really important distinction. Inspiration doesn't cause writing. Writing causes inspiration. So if you want to be a writer, you basically just get up and start writing. And I don't care if you're not feeling well, if you have the swine flu or whatever. I write 7 days a week, and trust me, most of those days I can think of 1,000 things to do besides sit down and write. But once I start writing, that's where inspiration comes from. I wrote Peak because I saw an interview on TV years ago with a woman who was trying for her third time to get to the summit of Mount Everest. And they got to the end of the interview, and the interviewer says, you're a single mom of a 5-year-old daughter. What have you done for your daughter if by some unfortunate chance you die on Mount Everest, which of course is always a possibility? And her answer was this. This is a direct quote. She said, I wrote my daughter a bunch of letters. And that might be one of the most outrageous things I've ever heard in my life. I'm certain that that little girl, her mom died, would much rather have her mom than a pile of stinking letters. And so it started me thinking a little bit about climbing Everest and why people do it, because thousands of people try every year. Last year, I think over 500 people made it to the top and 13 died. And that's not counting the people who lost things like noses and ears. They don't count those and the people that died. Why do it? I mean, you can climb perfectly safe lots of different mountains at the right time of year. They're exciting climbs. And since so many people have actually reached the summit, what's the point? And to me, I think the point is, and I know a lot of Everest climbers would totally disagree with me. In fact, I've met those people. I think you climb it to come down and tell people that you climbed it. And, you know, it costs about $100,000 to get up to the top. That's a lot of money. If I had a spare $100,000, I could think of much better ways of spending it than risking my life and maybe never seeing my family again than getting to the top of Peak so I can come down and, you know, stand up in front of all you guys and say, I've been to the top of Mount Everest.
Well, you do. You did a lot of research on that one, though.
I did.
And certainly it's kind of a specialized thing, having to exist in that death zone up there. And I thought that was pretty well depicted.
Yeah, thank you. And I wasn't a high altitude climber. I was a climber, but certainly in high altitude climbing is a totally different sport. And you know, I just think we need to look at all sides of everything. And my side is a little bit on the dark side of climbing Everest, I guess.
Well, your characters get goofy and dumb.
They actually drop in intelligence. They proved this quantitatively last year, that high-altitude climbers actually lose brain cells, and their IQ actually drops, and it's measurable.
The higher you climb on this, the deeper
exactly.
You're digging.
I mean, they're not coming down to the bottom of the mountain saying, 10-4, good buddy, or anything. I mean, you know, but they actually do lose intelligence because you're killing billions of brain cells when you're in an oxygen-deprived situation, and they've actually tracked some of these people. It's a minor part, but their intelligence is dropping. You know, their intellect is dropping, which is I don't think that's their ambition.
No, we're talking with Roland Smith, the author of Peak, among a number of other books, and we have a number of his young readers with us, high school and middle school students in Sitka and Anchorage, and also callers joining on the telephone, and one by email here, where Gary wants to...
probably climbers.
that could be, but Anne wanted to dispute about the sea otter, saying she thinks your mortality numbers are off, that actually the otter mortality was higher. In Valdez, at least, than the ones that got taken to Seward.
Well, she may be right. I mean, the 5,000 I mentioned is an estimate. We don't know for certain, but that's the general estimate that we sort of came up with. But I mean, it could be higher. It actually could be lower than that too. So, you know, no one knows exactly what the body count is.
All right, Sitka, at the roundtable, students, just stand by here, and we'll take a call here from David, and you can jump back in afterwards. David of Fairbanks, you're on the air with Roland Smith.
Hi, yeah. This is interesting. Earlier in the show, you were talking about To Kill a Mockingbird being one of your favorite books, and it's always been my favorite book, too. But I have a question. Do you know the significance of the title? I never have figured that out. Is it a symbol for one of the characters, or... How did she come up with the idea of To Kill a Mockingbird?
Well, I would like to meet her and ask her that question, plus about 1,000 other questions. It's actually a quote from, something about shooting something, but don't ever kill a mockingbird. And I don't know exactly what she meant by that. My assumption is, of course, her dad's defending basically an innocent person, and... He might be sort of an allegory to the mockingbird. I'm guessing. You know, I mean, the only one that can answer that would be Harper Lee. Let's call her up.
All right. I'll
that'd be fun.
I put my producer right on that.
On the phone, that would be great. I'd just love to find out a whole lot about that book. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, it is indeed, David.
That's perfect voice.
Thank you for your call, David.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
We don't have an answer for your question, however. Okay, in Sitka, somebody at the roundtable got one for Roland Smith.
For Peak again, we had it up here as a Battle of the Books book, and it's a pretty neat feat to have that there. It was definitely opened my eyes to some of these books, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're really welcome. It was a really interesting book for me to write. It took a couple of years. I used to be a climber, and when you're a climber, there's certain language that climbers use, what we call nomenclature, and then there's high-altitude vocabulary, and I had to use enough to where people who actually climb knew that I knew what I was talking about, but not enough to confuse the non-climber, you know, because we all talk in this kind of climbing slang thing. And it's also sort of an interesting thing because it's you have to go up and then down and up and down and up and down. I mean, the technique of climbing Everest is actually a little bit redundant. And so one of the challenges of writing that book was to make that rather redundant, boring, you know, climb high, sleep low, over and over again, kind of interesting. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Because that's why it takes 3 months. You don't just kind of walk up the mountain. You got to acclimate yourself. And that acclimation process takes months. And so one of the challenges of writing that book was to try to make that period of time interesting for the reader because, man, I mean, it would be really boring just to go over and over that again and again. But thank you. I'm really glad you liked the book.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting to see how your own experience informs these many books you've written because in this case, being someone who is pretty acquainted with the climber's culture, you nailed that pretty well.
Yeah, well, you know, I live in Oregon, you know, 50 miles from Mount Hood, and you know, up here in Alaska, too, there's a lot of climbers. We're kind of sort of immersed in that, in sort of that culture, you know.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, you know, a lot of the climbers that you portray are rich clients, the rich client climber, and the emotionally immature climber who takes unnecessary risks and pays the ultimate price, and so forth.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of different types of climbers. And when you actually are climbing, and I haven't climbed for years, but you run into them all, you know. So you're climbing a rock, and you're using all sorts of ropes and safety things, and then somebody's kind of trying to crawl up it backwards without any net or rope or anything, and you're going, what are you doing? They go, climbing. And then they fall, and you go, wow, I bet that hurt.
I'd like to ask my Anchorage panel here, Ben, can you put your finger on what it is that hooks you about Roland Smith's books?
I don't know. It just seems to me like the books seem very realistic. Like I could actually see that happening to somebody. Probably not to me, because my dad doesn't run an airline company like in Zach's Live. But there could certainly be kids out there that have to go through what Zach went through or what Jacob went through or Peak. So that's what I like about the books the most, is that they could actually exist somewhere.
Becca?
I enjoy the emotional changes, actually. Like in the beginning of Zach's lie, he is a generally happy child, pretty much. And throughout the book, as he's going through the witness security program, he starts off to go downhill with his emotions, and then he's trying to climb back up eventually.
That's actually a very good outline of his emotional arc, Becca. I mean, that's exactly true. Because he lost everything. You know, you have everything, you're happy, and then suddenly all that gets pulled out from under you, and then you got to, like you said, we're doing the climbing thing again, but you got to kind of climb back up again.
Yeah. I'll have to say what really interests me is the moral element. It really seems that your characters undergo a moral evolution. And, of course, for a young person, you damn well want that. But it's, you know, also you see it in the fathers to some degree and the other characters in the book.
Yeah, and I should mention, when I write a book, I don't really think about that very much. I think it is a sort of recurring theme in a lot of my books, but it's not something I consciously think of. Because this is a little tip for writers out there, you really don't want to write a book with the idea that you want to teach a lesson. Because then you're going to get really preachy. What you want to do is basically tell a story that's hopefully realistic and based on things that people can relate to. And I'm sure that all sorts of morals and themes kind of emerge. And I get lots of email, of course, and people say, "What is the theme of your book?" Of course, they're trying to cheat and get the theme from me for their school. So I know better than to answer them. But the truth is that I don't really even think about a theme when I'm writing a book. And a novel doesn't have one theme; it has lots of themes, and the theme can be different. It depends on who reads it, because we all bring our own sensibilities to whatever book we read.
Yes, but, it's interesting, pin down your favorite book is To Kill a Mockingbird, and, there's certainly a very strong moral thread to that.
There is, absolutely.
Let's go to Robert, joins the program from Fairbanks. Robert, you're on the air with Roland Smith.
Yes, hello, Roland. I was interested in your description of using notebooks and so forth to write, I was wondering, my question really regards process. As you have described, you've, used a notebook and written a lot in that, and then what happens? What do you do next?
Well, what happens then, of course, I'm very paranoid about it, because if I lose the notebook, it's bad news, because I can't back it up on a flash drive. So I carry those things with me. When the rough draft is finished, I very quickly put that into a computer, and where I can actually back it up. And when I put it in, that's kind of like the second draft. And let me talk a little bit more about notebooks and why I write that way. And there's a lot of different ways of writing. Is I run into a lot of people, and they say, when I retire, I'm going to write a book, or I don't have time to write a book, or there's all sorts of excuses people have, and by writing, if you write by hand, there's a lot of 10, 15, 20-minute periods in a day where you're not really doing much of anything except waiting, like waiting for a phone call, in my case, waiting to go speak. And if you have your book with you, you can just take it out. Some people say, well, I need big blocks of time. You actually don't need blocks of time. What you need to do is you need to manage your time in a way where you can spend your spare time working. And the best way to do that is to have a notebook, because you can just pull it out of your pocket and start working on your book. And you'd be surprised how patient it makes you. If, like my wife loves going to the mall, and I'm good at the mall for about 2 minutes. But I love hanging with her. But I just bring my book. And so when she's, doing whatever she does at the mall, I just find a nice little corner to sit in and pull out my book, and I don't really care how long she takes, because I'm working, and I'm working on my story. And so I think we need to look at time and writing a little bit differently. If you wrote one page a day, which is like not very much, in a year you'd have a 365-page novel.
Whoa!
Are you perhaps familiar with a live scribe?
Oh, we were just talking about that at dinner last night, as a matter of fact. Yeah, I am. I'm a real gizmo guy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I looked at those. I'm not really sure that way.
work for me, but I've seen them. They're kind of cool.
Robert, go ahead.
I can tell you my son uses one for taking notes in school. You know, you're talking about notebook-based writing, et cetera, and he can get a whole semester of all his classes, all his notes taken, the classes recorded, and daily downloaded to his computer where it comes up exactly as it is written, and then you can simply run that through a small piece of software that'll turn it into a word processing document. It very well could be an extremely valuable tool.
Whoa. Well, I'm getting one.
It's sold.
Every day, I certainly appreciate you.
I think we have lunch. I think at lunch I'll go out and get one right now. I mean, because we were just talking about it at dinner last night. It's very funny you bring that up. And because I kind of seen them advertising in magazines and stuff, and I thought, what is this thing? And then they were talking about them last night, the librarians and teachers, and I went, now you brought it up again. So I think this is serendipity.
It is a genuine paradigm shift.
Okay, right. I gotta spend some more money. All right.
Okay, our telephone number.
Cheap.
All right.
Cheap.
We got to take a break. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Our guest is Roland Smith. He's talking to us from the high school in Sitka. He's the author of Peak, Zach's Lie, Thunder Cave, many other books. And he'll be right back when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Does your child not look at you when you talk to him? Are you worried your child doesn't play with other children? Or do you wonder why your child seems to be in her own world? Well, these could be the early signs of autism. For more information about autism and resources in your community, visit autism.alaska.gov or call 1-800-799-7570. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Sitting around a speakerphone in Sitka is the librarian, the school, high school librarian, Jenny Blackson, one of the creators of this wonderful Spirit of Reading project, and a bunch of students with author Roland Smith. Why don't you guys take it away for a while here?
Hey, Steve, Jenny has something to say, actually. Why don't we give it to her for a second?
You bet.
I just wanted to let the listeners know about the rest of Roland's trip. Roland has been a real trooper for us this year. This is the second year of our program. He was in Ketchikan on Sunday and spoke at the Ketchikan Regional Youth Facility High School and the Ketchikan Public Library. He's been everywhere in Sitka, I think. And then we're putting him on a plane tonight, and he's going to Fairbanks, and he's going to be at the Fairbanks Regional Youth Facility tomorrow, and he's going to be at the Fairbanks Public Library tomorrow night. And then Thursday, he's going to be at three different schools in Fairbanks, and then he's going to Bethel, where he's going to be speaking at the Bethel Regional Youth Facility and do two presentations in an elementary school in Bethel. And this is the first year that we've added visits to the regional youth facilities, so it's a new program for us. And then we've already made our arrangements for next year, and we're going to have the author Will Hobbs up to Alaska. And we've partnered with public libraries, and so we're going to have copies of Will's books in the public libraries this summer for summer reading program. And we have a really easy way to find out what's going on with Spirit of Reading. We have a website that's www.akspiritofreading.com, where you can find out what's going on. And through a wonderful grant from the Alaska State Library and from support from the Alaska Association of School Libraries, every year we buy 500 to 800 books by our authors and send those to students and libraries around the state free of charge. In Alaska, we are a book-poor state, and we hear from librarians often that they don't have books for their students, and so the whole focus of this program is to put books in the hands of students, and as an extra bonus, they get to meet the author and have interactions with them.
All right, Jenny, we have in the library in Sitka, I believe we have some kids on the phone, but Ben's got a question from Anchorage.
I was wondering, Roland, do you have any special places or times of the day that you get ideas for new books, or do they just kind of spontaneously come to you?
That's a great question. Actually, I get ideas for new books while I'm working on other books, and I get really good ideas when I'm working on a book for another book. The trick is not to act on that. Because if you do, then you won't finish the book you're working on. And so you kind of get excited about it. So you make a note about the book that you're thinking about doing in the future and then quickly try to forget it. Because otherwise you won't finish the book you're working on. And one mistake that I made, certainly, and a lot of new authors make, is they start working on a book, they get an idea for another book, they stop working on the first book, and they start working on the second book. And this kind of goes on ad infinitum forever, and then they never finish anything. And one thing that distinguishes a writer that's successful and one that isn't is that we actually finish books. And,
let's go to the Sitka Library now. Is somebody on the phone from Sitka?
Yes.
Go right ahead. Do a question for Roland Smith. We've got about 2 minutes.
Do you always go to the place? Do you always research?
They get the radio on in there, too. But I think you got the question. On-scene research, Roland.
I got it. He's asking if I always go to the places that I write about, and the answer is no. I go to a number of them. Like, have I been to Mount Everest? No. And I have actually no desire to go on to Mount Everest.
We gathered that.
It's not on my bucket list at all. But other places I do go. When I wrote a novel called Elephant Run. It takes place in Burma during World War II, and I had to go to Burma to do the research for that book because there isn't, it's a military dictatorship, not a lot of information on it. You can't learn much about it except by going there. So I spent a month in the jungle of Burma working with elephants, and that's the only way I could have actually gotten that information. So the answer is sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. It sort of depends on the book I'm working on and how similar it is to other places that I've been. I've been traveling for 40 years, so I've been a lot of places, but not everywhere.
Whoa. Okay, Becca, you got the last question. Becca Patrick.
Okay. If you could hang out with one character from Peak, Thunder Cave, or Zack's Lie, who would you hang out with?
Wow. I would probably hang out with Peak, I guess. I mean, you know, I kind of like Jake Lanson, too. I'd like to hang out with both of them, actually. But probably Peak. He's got an interesting kid. What's interesting about him is that he does these sort of amazing things, but he never tells anybody about them. And I kind of, like, deeply admire that, people who do things and then don't have to mention them in order to get high off of it.
Thank you, Roland Smith, and thank you, students. It's Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by the Alaska Children's Trust, sponsor of the Alaska Parent Line, providing parenting information, 1-800-643-5437. North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you file for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give. The University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.